Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm well.
I'm happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up, Oscar nominations are here. Planning for the ceremony has begun. Much to discuss. Let's dive in. Let's talk nominees first. Jane Campion's The Power of the Dog led the way with 12 nominations, including nominees in every major category for which it was eligible. Dune, meanwhile, was the biggest box office hit of the year to rack up nominations, scoring 10 of them, including Best Picture. And crowd pleasers like Belfast and West Side Story each got 7 noms, while King Richard grabbed 6, including Will Smith's 3rd and 4th Oscar nominations for Best Actor and as producer on a Best Picture nominated film. This is his 3rd Best Actor nomination. I think there's a decent chance this is his year. We'll see. I don't know. Don't Look Up grabbed a Best Picture nod, but somewhat more confusingly, it also got a Best Original Screenplay nod. I don't know if anybody... I haven't read the screenplay. Maybe it's brilliant, but judging by what's on the screen, maybe that was a mistake. I don't know. And with 4 nominations, but none in the acting categories, it seems pretty unlikely that it will win Best Picture, thankfully. Fingers crossed on that one. You'll never know. But what will? What will? I am not terribly fond of the idea of snubs in the Oscars. No film deserves a little gold man or even a chance at winning one. But I was a little bit disappointed to see No Love for Pig or Red Rocket or The French Dispatch, kind of most surprisingly. And Spider-Man No Way Home got just 1 nomination, leading to outrage from Oscar pundits and the patron saint of nerddom, Kevin Smith. Saying that, you know, where's the love for Peter Parker, man? But hey, I'm sure audiences are still going to tune into the Oscars because who doesn't want to see if the 3-hour Japanese drama Drive My Car takes away a bunch of nominations, right? That's what we're all here for. Anyway, the show itself is shrouded in mystery. The Hollywood Reporter suggests that they will have 3 hosts, each tackling an hour of the ceremony. Because as we all know, the reason that the show has been in calamitous ratings decline is the shortage of the number of talking heads introducing the other people who are going to talk about the movies that are going to win the awards. More amusing was word that the Oscars themselves would not require attendees to be vaccinated in order to come to the show. There is, of course, an amusing hypocrisy angle to all this. Everybody loves hypocrisy. The mecca of liberal Hollywood is refusing to engage in mandates or vaccine cards or, you know, whatever, you know, little folks have to deal with. That's not for them. As I noted on Twitter, though, I would pay $200. I would pay $200 cash to anybody who gave me a list of the nominees that would not be allowed to come to the ceremony if ushers were checking vaccination cards, because that's literally the only reason the Oscars aren't requiring this. They don't want to embarrass any big stars. And, you know, LA is already kind of weird with vaccines as it is. God only knows who hasn't gotten their shots. And as we were going to air today, we're taping on Monday, as always, we found out that the Oscars is going to do a Twitter vote on most popular movie and the biggest crowd-pleasing, cheering moment. And all I have to say to that is I hope we're all ready for Academy Award-winning Zack Snyder's Justice League coming up, because if there's any group that knows how to rig a Twitter poll, it is the Release the Snyder Cut folks. So this is all very exciting. But again, the big question is who's going to win? Who's winning? Who's losing? Alyssa, which movie do you think will win Best Picture? Which movie do you want to win Best Picture? Perhaps more importantly.
I am terrible at Oscarology, and I'm just going to say that I assume the sheer number of nominations The Power of the Dog got meant that it's going to win and that Jane Campion's probably going to win for Best Director because people seem excited to give Jane Campion more statuettes. And like you, a lot of my favorite movies of the year are just nowhere in this conversation, right? Like No Pig, No The Last Duel, which honestly is one of the movies from last year that has most stuck on my mind and that I think is most sort of interesting and accomplished in ways that I would have loved to see be part of the conversation. No, The French Dispatch. And so given this list, I think the movie that I'm probably rooting for is Dune, both because, you know, it is a spectacle that is a testament to the power of theatrical movie going, and also because of the degree of difficulty involved and the extent to which Denis Villeneuve and everyone involved just really stuck the landing. It's an extremely enjoyably acted movie. It looks and sounds incredible. And it is a really deft adaptation of material that has long been considered basically impossible to do well. So of my available choices, that's probably where my heart is leading me. But, you know, Oscars for Pig, man, you know, just this, the scene in the restaurant with where with, you know, Nicolas Cage casually destroying another person's sense of himself. I don't know if that's not Oscar worthy. I don't know what it is.
Yeah. Kind of surprised, Peter, that Denis Villeneuve was snubbed for the best director. You know, everyone, that's a big, big product, a big production. Nobody wants to see that guy get miss out on his chance to win an Oscar for Dune. But
especially since Dune is a movie that is just so directed, right? I mean, it's not, you know, it's in a different way than, say, something like The French Dispatch, but it is very much the product of a singular directorial vision. It feels like, it doesn't feel like somebody just made Dune, although it does certainly feels like somebody adapted Frank Herbert and was in many ways faithful to and, you know, loved the source material. But it also really feels like a Denis V production, right? This like is a movie that is drawing from and built out of all of his visual obsessions.
And oral obsessions as
yes.
well.
Yes.
Yeah. If this movie, if Dune doesn't win best sound, I would be very surprised. I mean, I feel like there will be a very strong campaign there. And also best score. I'm cheering for best score, but I feel like Peter might have thoughts on that as well. I feel like Peter has stronger thoughts on scores than either Alyssa or I usually do.
I mean, the sound in Dune is incredible and just a great test of your like home theater speaker system. Also a reason to go out to a movie theater. It is, I mean, if Dune wins for best sound design or for best score, it will prove the adage that the movie that wins for in the sound categories always wins for most sound, because there is an awful lot of sound. And it's a little like the, you know, the complaints or, you know, the kind of quasi-criticisms that all of the costume Oscars always end up going to super elaborate period pieces rather than much more subtle contemporary films where the costume designer has figured out how to use more ordinary and contemporary clothing in order to tell a story and to help sell the characters. And I think that's fair to some extent. At the same time, like, Dune just is more striking aurally than almost anything I've heard, certainly than anything else I heard in the last year, and than most of the things I've heard, you know, in a decade or two. And it's just the kind of movie that you want to go and listen to. And the audio sells the story and sells the picture, and they are sort of like, this is, there is a, you know, there's a school of film criticism that just talks about film as story. It just talks about film as character, right? Basically treats it as a kind of like, oh, this is a visual novel. And I think that those things are interesting, and it's not like you should ignore story and character, but there's another school of film criticism that I've always felt myself a little more attached to that treats film fundamentally as shots, cuts, and sound decisions, right? That it's just the exclusively cinematic elements that make film film, and that's what critics should focus on the most. I don't think that I fully agree, like I said, with either school. You know, at the same time, if I'm going to count myself on one side or another, it's that I think that film critics should always be thinking most about the things that are essentially cinematic. And Dune is, to me, the most essentially cinematic, maybe along with The French Dispatch, but I think the most essentially cinematic film of the year. And it is also, it's also the only film on this list that is very clearly a popular film. And so
I don't know that's true. I don't know. I think you could make the case for Don't Look Up, which was the second most popular film in the history of Netflix, which is not nothing. It's not nothing to sneeze
at. Do we actually think people watched it all the way through and like paid attention to it? Or do we think that put it on and made some Hot Pockets and caught like some funny Leonardo DiCaprio bits?
Some Totino's, had some pizza rolls. I mean, it's hard to say. It's because nobody knows. I mean, I am not one of these people who says, oh, well, if you know, it did 400 million minutes of viewing, then that means it would have grossed $2.6 billion. I mean,
so let's say that Dune then is the film that is most clearly a popular film by the classic definition.
Sure.
Which is, this is a big budget movie that actually did reasonably well. I think not as well as it would have in a non-pandemic scenario, but did reasonably well at the box office. And that was at least mostly liked by critics and mostly liked by viewers, right? It is a populist and popular film, more so, at least more classically than any other film on this list. And so that's why I think it's the film that I think that I would like to see win out of the pictures that were nominated anyway. And it's also why I think that this is even though Power of the Dog kind of looks like the winner on paper here, it's why I think that Dune stands a chance of becoming the winner, is because I think there's pretty clearly a sense of anxiety within the Academy over the last couple of years that the Academy Awards have become a prestige honor for a little scene film that nobody cares about. And that's why the awards themselves are losing stature. Richard Rushfeld at The Ankler has written about this, about like the way the power of the Oscars has shrunk. Now, part of that last year was just, it was a pandemic year. It was weird. A lot of movies didn't come out, but it was happening slowly even before that happened, which is why we saw the Academy attempt to sort of write this by talking about setting up a best popular film
category,
which was just insane. And they never figured out how they were going to do that. But they recognized that they had a problem with not honoring films that ordinary viewers, the people that they that studios yeah. want to connect with, actually saw or cared about in any way. And I don't think Don't Look Up may meet that test better than some of the other films on this list. It may even meet that test better than Nomadland, which was last year's winner. But I don't think of Don't Look Up as a true popular film in the classic sense. The only thing on that list that is Dune. And Dune happens to be a pretty great movie as well. And so I think it both should win. And I also think that it has a pretty good chance of winning, even though, like Alyssa, I am terrible at predicting the Oscars.
I don't think Dune has much of a chance of winning, honestly. And I don't think that I think the argument that this is a popular film, so it should be awarded, actually works against it in a weird way, because I think there's a very vocal and strong pushback against that sort of thing in the Academy. I mean, I think if they're going to find a settle choice, right? If they're going to settle on something that is in theaters and has done well with audiences, even if it hasn't put up the box office, it's going to be something like Belfast or West Side Story, which both have got plenty of nominations, are both very, very much liked, and are like kind of crowd pleasing sorts of films. Belfast more so than West Side Story, at least in terms of how it sends you out of the screening room. But I do think that I would be surprised if The Power of the Dog won. I wouldn't be shocked, but I would be surprised, because it is, I don't know, it's kind of...
Belfast is not that much of a crowd pleaser. I mean, I agree it plays like one, but the movie made $21.5 million at the U.S. box office. It pleased very few crowds. No, I like that movie too.
I mean, I agree. I understand that argument, but that doesn't change the fact that the audiences who do see it and the sort of people who go to see it are the sort of old Academy voters who are going to be watching it at home on DVD anyway.
I think Jane Campion Best Director, but Dune wins Best Picture, and it will be a weird director picture split. That raises the eternal question, can you have the best movie but not the best director?
Best director, yeah. I mean, I assume the fact that Alana Haim didn't get nominated for Best Actress means Licorice Pizza has no chance. And also, I think that's nonsense. I think she makes that movie. And it is insane to me to see it nominated for Best Picture without her getting nominated for Best Actress. But maybe that's just me.
What do you guys make of this idea of having, people on Twitter vote for their favorite movies, and then they're going to pick three of the folks to come to the Academy next year and give an award? They want normal people on the stage. What if the three of us, what if we vote and we all get it and we can go and we could pitch across the movie aisle to the, at this
cinema
point.
Cinema brings America together.
By this point, there will only be like 4 million people watching the Oscars, so it won't be really that much bigger of an audience than our show, which does millions upon millions of downloads.
The Academy often seems out of touch. It's true. But I think this is one place where they've really, put their finger on the pulse of real America, because that's where the normal people are, is on Twitter.
Yeah.
It's right. One thing that we all know is that Twitter is where the normies are.
Yes.
That's
why 20% of America, all of whom are normies.
Yeah, it's gonna end up being some weird letterboxed movie, and the person who wins is gonna go up there and like give a speech in all lowercase letters somehow. We'll know through the screen that it's an irony soaked diatribe. Well, and finally, we do. I am curious to think about who they're going to pick to host this thing, because it is a.
I think as we were starting to tape, they announced that it's going to be Amy Schumer, Wanda Sykes, and Regina King.
Did they actually? Or I heard it was. I heard that was rumored. Is that for sure?
Thought Variety said
that. Check? Let's do some live efforting while we're talking here.
Variety says
Amy Schumer, Regina Hall, and Wanda Sykes. There we go. So that sounds terrible. I got to be honest. That does not sound like a hosting trio that interests me, because I wanted Aaron Rodgers, Joe Rogan, and Dave Chappelle to be the three hosts. I feel like that would be the unity ticket there.
It would be a talker.
That's the unity ticket.
Certainly be a talker.
And then Ricky Gervais comes out to give best picture. He's got his pint of beer, and he's like, oh, I hate all of you people.
This raises the question. You're all losers. Who's the most inoffensive person in Hollywood?
I mean, I assume it's Dwayne Johnson, right?
Or Tom Hanks?
Tom Hanks. Dwayne Johnson. You know who is the secret candidate for this? Is Bob Odenkirk. Because everybody loves that guy. And when he had his, I believe it was a heart attack, when he had his health issue on the set of Better Call Saul, like normally that's the time when you see the 10% of people, even for like a beloved star, who come out and be like, actually, this guy sucks, because you remember in 2005, he did this one thing to his ex and it was so mean. And like, no, I don't feel like I genuinely did not see one mean tweet about Bob Odenkirk, like one mean snarky article in a bad tabloid. It was all, everybody was just like, man, that's sad. We all love Bob. Come back, Bob. Maybe Bob Odenkirk should host the Oscars. I would actually watch that. He was so great in Mr. Show. He's like actually funny and clever. He's also turns out to be a pretty great dramatic actor. He actually has the chops to do it. But of course, he's a middle-aged white guy. And I feel like the Oscars are trying to move beyond that.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. We'll get Amy Schumer and the rest.
That'll be great.
Why not just have Schumer and Tina Fey do it? They put together a couple good shows for the Globes, right?
Wasn't that Amy Poehler?
Amy Poehler? Oh no, sorry, Amy Poehler.
You're canceled.
Not Amy Schumer. God, this sounds awful. Actually, I'm not looking.
The good news for you is that each hour, the host that you don't like will be done, right? So you'll only have to go through 1 hour of each host. No, but the question then is
happens
when...
But it's still going to be 3 hours long.
That's short. These things often run closer to four. My question is, what happens when inevitably the Oscars runs to 3 hours and 42 minutes, when it's, you know, the Apocalypse Now Redux plus a couple of, like, plus the behind the scenes...
That's when Ricky Gervais comes parachuting in.
Dwayne Johnson and Vin Diesel will take the stage and fight to the death.
All right. Well, I don't know. I am very skeptical about how all this is going to work.
I feel like we learned a lot in this segment.
I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen here. But I do think I have a feeling. I have a feeling, and it's a dumb bad feeling. I'm just going to guess that Belfast wins. So I'm going to throw that out there. We can come back to that. People can yell at me in a month when I'm wrong.
Aren't all your feelings dumb and bad, Sonny?
No, many of my feelings are dumb and good. So that's
I feel like many of your feelings are smart and bad.
that's like the four quadrants of Sonny, right? There's smart and bad, smart and good, dumb and bad, dumb and good. And like, I don't know.
The Oscars, folks.
The Oscars. Every Oscar thought goes in dumb and bad. All right, that's it for this dumb segment. A quick programming note. Rather than posting both episodes of Across the Movie Aisle on Tuesday, as we have been doing, we've decided to spread the love a little bit. We're going to put main episodes up on Tuesday. They'll be available simultaneously on Substack and your preferred podcast app, you know, iTunes, Spotify, whatever. I don't think we're on Stitcher. I hate Stitcher. Maybe we are. If you're listening to this on Stitcher, I apologize. The Stitcher people are weird. The bonus episode will post on Fridays, and it will continue to only be available to members of Bulwark Plus. So sign up today at atma.thebulwark.com to get the bonus episode that's going to be on Fridays. You can also get an RSS feed that'll take your take the show right to your, you know, Spotify or iTunes or whatever. Again, like, actually, I don't think it does Spotify. It doesn't matter. Point is, if you sign up for Bulwark Plus, you get the RSS feed. It works great. This week's bonus episode, since I've been talking about it, it's going to be a sad one. Tribute to the life and work of Ivan Reitman, who passed away last night as the Super Bowl was happening. Again, we're taping on Monday, happened on Sunday. Very sad. So we're going to be talking about him. And now on to the main event, Death on the Nile. consider this your spoiler warning. If you've never read the book or seen the movies, look out. Spoilers are coming your way. Kenneth Branagh returns to the role of Hercule Poirot and hops back on the director's chair for the sequel to Murder on the Orient Express, which sees the world's most famous detective take his talents to Egypt. But before he gets there, we spend a few minutes learning the secret origin of his incredible, indelible mustache. That's right. It's a somber black and white origin story about his facial hair, and it helps us understand the backstory of this fastidious crime solver, et cetera, but mostly, you know, the mustache. Where did that mustache come from? Now we know. And then after that, we shift to the reason we're all here. Murder! The murders. The plot is relatively straightforward. Poirot joins newlyweds Simon Doyle, who's played by Armie Hammer, and the fabulously wealthy Lynette Ridgway, Gal Gadot, on a Nile cruise as they attempt to flee Simon's jilted lover, Jacqueline de Belfort, who is played by Emma Mackey. She is obsessed with ruining their honeymoon because they were engaged. Now they're not engaged. It's very sad. Joining the happy couple and the unhappy detective attempting to keep an eye on the proceedings is a colorful cast of side characters played by luminaries like Annette Bening, Letitia Wright, Russell Brand, Rose Leslie, and others. All of them are suspicious in their own right, and all of them become all of them become suspects after someone dies, and then another person dies, and then a third person dies. After that, so many deaths, so many tears in the fabric of society, so many chances for Branagh to look morose as he contemplates not only the thin and weary nature of our souls, but also man's inhumanity to his fellow, whatever. You know, you get the idea. Look, here's the thing. I actually really like the simplicity of the storytelling and the not quite convoluted nature of the murder mystery. It's like fake convoluted, can we say, right? It's not really that convoluted. It's pretend convoluted, if that makes sense. More than that, though, I just enjoyed watching beautiful people dressed up in nice fancy clothes engaging with human emotions like lust and jealousy and maternal affection, et cetera, et cetera. Despite being faintly ridiculous, as all such murder mysteries are and kind of have to be to make sense, it's a movie that's very emotionally grounded. It felt like adults were doing adult things on a big screen. What a rare sight. I do have complaints. The mustache intro, for starters. But also, the thing, it looks weirdly cheap. Looks weirdly cheap anytime we see an exterior shot or a background. Like, it was all shot in a studio, and it was just this terrible green screen behind them, and it made everything look fake. Like, the shadows and the lighting was all wrong. Just all wrong, all wrong, all wrong. Never mind. I liked it enough to give all these hiccups a pass. Peter, judging by your review, you seem to disagree with me that this is a good, watchable, entertaining movie. Why do you insist on being wrong?
I think it's you who's wrong, Sonny, and I just have to say that it sounds like you're in denial.
Oh, boo! I wish I had a mute button. I would go right to Alyssa.
No, I didn't like this movie very much. I wanted to like it. I like Kenneth Branagh. I didn't mind Murder on the Orient Express, which is basically a sequel to. It was Branagh's previous Agatha Christie Hercule Poirot adaptation. I grew up watching Hercule Poirot mysteries, you know, on PBS with my parents. We have a big stack of Agatha Christie novels at my house, even though I have to admit I have read very, very few of them and have not read the novel Death on the Nile here. But I wanted to like this movie. It's like the sort of thing that should appeal to me. And it just didn't work for me. So a big part of it was that it felt not just cheap, but sort of cheap in a way that I felt like was contrary to the appeal of a kind of movie like this, right? So this is not quite a giant budget film, but it cost about $90 million to make, and it should feel luxurious. And instead, we had these kind of cheap-looking sets. Like, they actually looked sort of like stage sets in a lot of ways, even when they were scuffed up to look, you know, like they'd actually been worn and used. They didn't feel all that luxurious. And then you're constantly seeing the CG outdoors. And so it just felt like all this was happening like in the midst of Jon Favreau's The Jungle Book, except not quite as good, right? The CG was not nearly as effective even as in that movie. In that movie, it was a little bit weird, right? It's like they're going through the uncanny valley of the kings the whole time. And it's super distracting. And then I felt like the plotting in this movie is it's not... it's not too convoluted, but it is quite slow. And the pacing, I think, is really off. The central murder doesn't happen until almost exactly midway through the movie, about 1 hour in. And in, I would like to say, oh, that's just careful, methodical plotting, right? It's slow moving, and it's, but it's like it's getting you somewhere. It doesn't build tension at all. You know exactly what's going to happen. You're just sort of marking time waiting to get there. It's very clear who is going to die first, and also who's going to, who the killer is going to be from about scene three or four here. I had in my notes that I wrote out the exact thing that was going to happen almost exactly by like 20 minutes into this movie. And so there's a 40 minute stretch through the sort of first part of act two that just feels like, what are we doing here? Let's knock some people off and get this movie going, because the movie does actually get somewhat more interesting in the second half, but it takes so long to get there. And I felt like it really burned a lot of goodwill beforehand. I also just didn't feel like the stars or the costumes beyond the setting. I didn't feel like the stars or the costumes were really all that glamorous. They felt sort of contrived to me in some way. They felt like they weren't, like there's something, there was no sort of real texture or like actual like luxury to them. It was like they were designed to sort of give in an almost stagey way the impression of luxury without actually having it. And it felt sort of not quite like a you know, PBS or BBC level cheap adaptation, but like something that was reaching for a kind of level of glamour that it really didn't achieve at all.
I remain shocked by how bad the exterior background work was, and like how bad even little things like the CGI Karnak on the Nile was, with like the CGI sailboats around it. I was genuinely kind of shocked. Like it needed, the thing it reminded me the most of, weirdly, was the X-Men Origins Wolverine movie which had some of like really genuinely just some of the worst CGI I've ever seen, like when Wolverine's claws pop out. Like it was like everything needed two or three more renders through the CGI processor.
It just really pales in comparison to a lot of the kind of pricey stuff that we are seeing on TV right now. I've been watching The Book of Boba Fett, and whatever else you might say about that show, the last couple of episodes in particular look really great. I also happened to watch The Last Night in Soho, which is a very different kind of movie, but another adult film, another R-rated film targeted, you know, at adults, right? It's not like a superhero film. It's an original by Edgar Wright. And that movie just looks so good, and its period work feels so real and so tactile and so alive. Even though some of it is CG, some of it's just dressed up, street scenes, and Death on the Nile just looked tacky a lot of the time.
One of the things I think is interesting and tricky about filming this particular work is that, I mean, you can't film on location, both because Egypt is unstable, but also because it looks so radically different, right? I mean, Cairo has grown tremendously. There's a lot more air pollution. Most of all, the critical scenes that are shot at Abu Simbel, you can't do now because the statues from Abu Simbel, that whole archaeological site, had to be removed when they built the Aswan Dam and flooded Abu Simbel, which is now under Lake Nasser, right? So those artifacts exist, but they're like, they can't be reached that way. Right. My parents actually saw them in the original setting before they were moved. And that's like one of the things that I am always sad that I will never get to do. But you know, you can't shoot on location, but yeah, it should have looked better, and it's a bummer.
Alyssa, you like this novel, right? This is one of your...
Yeah, I like Agatha Christie. I like mysteries a lot, and I hadn't read Death on the Nile in a while, but after, on my way home from seeing it, I stopped at my local bookstore and just picked up a paperback copy of it so I could read it again. And one of the things that's interesting about reading it and comparing it to the novel is that it's a fairly brittle, almost nasty comedy of manners, much more so than it actually is a mystery. Like, it's really just a sort of social novel in which everybody is a snob or a social climber or a crook. And I mean, there are a couple of people who are decent in like a very sort of innocent way. But there isn't the kind of sort of more complicated, textured human decency that Branagh brings into the movie adaptation. And it's actually, I mean, it's a very plot-wise, it's just very different from the book itself. But both the book and I think Branagh's adaptation get at the extent to which murder brings everybody's secrets to the fore, right? Like it's effectively a tool for exposing social tensions. And the process of investigating a murder is a way to get at everybody's secrets, which are mostly motivated by sort of social opprobrium. In the original novel, it's a lot of sort of class drama instead of Mrs. Van Schuyler and her nurse actually being, you know, in a long-term romantic relationship in the movie. Mrs. Van Schuyler is a kleptomaniac in the book, and her nurse is basically has been hired to like look after her, return stuff, and smooth things over when she's caught stealing things, right? So it's, you know, in both cases, it's, you know, it's social stuff. But, you know, for example, the Otterbournes are, you know, they're a white family in the novel. And Salome Otterborn is a failed novelist and alcoholic who basically abuses her daughter. And, you know, it's a totally different dynamic here where Salome Otterborn is a really, you know, talented blues guitarist. She's really charming. She has a good relationship with her daughter, and that the, you know, change in the characters becomes a way to explore sort of upper crust racism instead. But I think both Branagh and Christie understand sort of what murder is good for as a storytelling tool. And though they handle it differently, both are effective in my reading of it. I agree with you about the CG looking terrible, Peter, but I enjoyed this more in part because I thought it was interesting and kind of enjoyable to see Gal Gadot play a character who is really an unappealing person. I mean, she, you know, as Wonder Woman, she has been so cast as this like sort of wide-eyed avatar of innocence and purity, and having, you know, kind of playing against that as Lynette Ridgway. And the movie doesn't lean quite as hard into her fundamental dislikability as the novel does. But at the same time, you know, Gadot does sometimes come across, you know, in person as a little
aloof?
Yeah, not even aloof, but sort of like reading the room wrong, right?
And clueless?
Yeah. And I thought that casting her in this role played on that in a sort of interesting way.
Can I just interrupt real quick to ask Alyssa?
Yeah.
And I guess Sunny too, but like Alyssa, did you think she was good in this? Because I thought that she looked the part and was just extremely flat and didn't bring anything to the role. And I don't dislike her as an actress, but I felt like she was just as good in this as she was in Red Notice.
No, I disagree with that pretty strongly. I think she is playing the character about perfectly. There's an aloofness to her. There is like a casual cruelty to her. There is a casual cluelessness to her as well. Just this idea that like, just because she can do something, she does. And that's what she does throughout the movie. I mean, the opening scene, she's stealing a woman's fiance out from right underneath her, like in front of all of our eyes. And it's like, it's borderline grotesque. And yet she sells it really well. I don't know.
Yeah, I would say I'm more on Sunny's side on this. I mean, she plays entitlement very well, I thought anyway.
I thought the opening scene was the point where she was used best in the film, but it struck me that like, I mean, I thought, or not the opening scene, but the scene after the prologue at the first time we were in the Blues Club. But it struck me that she was fairly flat there. It's just that Branagh shot her well. And I mean, maybe this is, you know, maybe I am not giving proper credit to, you know, who did that, who made those scenes, that scene work. And I think that's one of the better scenes in the movie, but it struck me as, all of these characters are flat and schematic. They're there to, they have one secret that comes out and then, right. And like, they're there to enact something, like sort of, they're motivated by exactly one thing. You can't tell really anything about any of them. And the actors don't give the characters much more life with the maybe exception of Branagh himself. Read incredibly one note to me, again, with the exception of Branagh and Poirot, but even there, he just comes across, he's like been reinterpreted as a superhero with weirdly where his origin story is how he got his mustache, just a totally bizarre choice. And I was totally disconnected from every single one of these characters. And I didn't feel like there was anything going on there besides each one of them has to show up, have their secret. They do one thing that you don't understand that is then explained by their secret. And then that's the movie.
Oh, I disagree. I mean, among other things, I thought it was really nice to see Letitia Wright on screen again and be reminded of, you know, just how delicate she can be when she wants to be. And it's kind of a bummer that I would bet she has probably kind of blown up her career over the last year.
And yeah, we should note that this movie was shot in at the end of 2019, pre-pandemic.
Yes. You know, I thought that Don French and Jennifer Saunders have actually worked together a lot in the past. We're like a quite good two-hander, in part because they are characters who are they're people who are for like all of their public appearances are playing what turns out to be a role. And then, you know, that when that is revealed, you know, you get to see their real selves. I thought those actresses had, you know, worked well together. I thought that was actually, you know, a kind of touching modern but not too modern interpolation, right? Like in the late 1930s, you definitely had, you know, lesbian couples living together under these sort of semblances of being old maids, et cetera. And I thought that was actually quite nicely done. I did find Russell Brand really distracting. Like, it took me a while to figure out that that was Russell Brand. And then I was like, wait, this is just wrong. It's like someone leached a bunch of his essence out of him and he's playing this physician. So I wouldn't say I thought it was like a uniformly greatly acted movie, but there were a couple of performances in there that hooked me more than clearly they did you, Peter.
And I'm always up for Armie Hammer being like kind of big and dumb and attractive and like occasionally flashing like real glimpses of anger. Like that is his best, I think, mode of work. And he does a good job here with that. I don't know, man. I think you're way off on this, Peter. I think you're way off. Apologize to the movie.
I'll never apologize to you, Sonny, but I'll apologize to Alyssa.
All right, that's fair. All right, so what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Death on the Nile? Alyssa?
Thumbs up. It's enjoyable.
Peter?
Thumbs down.
Thumbs up. Peter loses again. All right, so that is it for this week's show. If you loved it, make sure to check out our members-only bonus episode coming Friday to atma.thebulwark.com on the dearly departed Ivan Reitman and his body of work. Make sure to tell your friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we will die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at Sonny Bunch, and I will convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.